Your country is under attack from the far left. Pretty much wherever you live, odds are that your government is pushing a radical, harmful, woke agenda on the nation's children. It's opening the border and flooding the nations with migrants. It's destroying your economy, maybe even your job, with green nonsense. Here at The Trumpet, we warn about the danger from the far left. But we also warn about the danger from the far right. What then should you do to solve the problems in your country? We're going to explore this and more on today's Trumpet World. Welcome back to Trumpet World, our latest edition of the Trumpet print magazine. If all has gone well, should have just gone out to the printer as this issue goes up. It's an issue I think I'm especially excited to talk about because it gets to the heart of something that comes up so much on this show. This dichotomy of where people clearly see the evil of one side and so feel like they have to go and support the other, regardless of any problems there. And here to talk about this issue, we have back on the show Trumpet Assistant Managing Editor Philip Nice. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So just like last time, maybe we could begin by talking about some of the thinking that went into this issue. This is one I think that does have a particularly strong theme where quite a lot of the articles tie into this general question of where is the answer? Where is the solution where you have radical problems from one side and kind of radical problems on the other too?
Right. Yeah, it's something that came up in the meeting and we thought, well, it's kind of timeless. It's very topical because at least here in the United States, the elections, presidential elections are coming up. And this is our last issue. It'll arrive just right at, in the United States, right as those elections are occurring. And that's a great time to really kind of take a step back and with all the hype and all the money and all the arguing and all the consequence that there is to an American election or a national election in Europe or multinational election in Europe, to take a step back and to say, to learn some larger lessons, kind of what you said there earlier. It seems to be that human beings are excellent at identifying injustices and problems and deficiencies in their government. But we think we're way better than we actually are at solving them. We'll react to injustice is real and imagined, and there are plenty of real injustices. This is a human system that's 6,000 or that's thousands of years deep into all of its flaws and flawed foundations. So everywhere you look, there are problems, and that's not to say they shouldn't be identified, but we think we're way better than we are at solving them, because when you look at something that's so destructive and you say this policy or this administrator of policy or this institution is causing this and this, and you're right, then people are wide open to what you say should be the solution. But those are two different things. To be able to identify what's wrong is something that some are better than others at, and we should be thankful. I am thankful to those who can point out the problems in a particular system of government. But that does not mean that the next sentence out of their mouth is also true. It doesn't mean that their proposed solution is also true. That's why it's always easy to be the opponent of the incumbent, because the incumbent, the person in power, actually has to make the thing happen, has to deal with the shortcomings and so forth of the government. If you're not in power, you can say whatever you want. And that's just like one example to illustrate this larger point, that when Europe reacts against the horrible systems of government that it has right now. When Americans, if and when Americans react, and however strongly they react against the horrible government that they have right now, just the fact that they're getting rid of or reacting against a bad form of government does not mean that the other form of government is right. And it doesn't mean that splitting the difference is right either.
I think that's a good point about we're better at pointing out problems than we are at coming up with solutions. I think that does explain some of the underlying realities. Because I think we see this all the time where, like, politics is very much viewed as a two-team game. And it doesn't matter what the country is. If you point out all the flaws in Team A, it's kind of then it almost goes without saying to everyone watching that discussion that, oh, you must support Team B then. And I feel like, you know, for this show, like that confuses people at times, maybe new listeners and things like that. Like, you know, there'll be one show and we will devote a lot of that show to pointing out all the problems in Team A. And so they go, like, well, you must be a really strong Team B supporter. And then we have another show that talks about all the problems with Team B. And then everyone's like, oh, you must really support Team A. I mean, my article for this is called Who Will Drain Europe's Swamp? And this is why I'm really excited to bring this, because I think this is so relevant to a lot of what we talk about on this show for European politics. Because I'd say one of the most controversial, in terms of at least our community and feedback, things that we talk about is the problems with the AfD. And I very much sympathize with that. And I make this point a lot. Like, we live in a world where people have spent 8 years saying Donald Trump is a Nazi. And that is so clearly not true. And so when people say the alternative for Deutschland is a neo-Nazi party, has Nazi sympathy, like, of course people tune out. Because the media's cried wolf. But in this case, it is true. They do have all of these leaders that will deliberately echo Nazi policies, that do have a, like, very specifically a radical different vision of World War II, where the Nazis, if they weren't the good guys, were at least not really any worse than Britain and America. And rather than World War II being a battle of good versus evil, it was a battle of maybe communism versus capitalism, and the West was just on the wrong side, or just competing empires, and everybody was being selfish there, and the Nazis and Germany unfairly got landed with the blame. I do not think that is an unfair characterization of at least a strong segment of the Alternative for Deutschland, and I think that segment of the party would agree with that characterization of themselves. So, you know, we're pointing out the flaws in the AfD, but we do get people that write in and, like, yeah, but the government that we've got right now is horrible. They're doing terrible things to Germany. They have the borders wide open, that it's causing all of this migrant crime. There's been all of these stabbings over the course of the summer. They're destroying the economy. You know, there are all of these green issues that you know, our energy prices are sky high because of them, and you can't buy a proper heating boiler because of what they're doing, and they're destroying our car industry by trying to force everyone to buy electric cars that they don't want. Why are you talking about down the AfD and these people? Because it's the mainstream and the center-left party that's destroying our country. And we're kind of like, yeah, you're right. They are doing that. Both sides are a problem. And that's a core part of the message of this issue.
Right. I remember, I think it might have been you, even in college, first reporting on the AfD. And I remember us discussing as a department, well, these are far right. And I remember asking, are they far right? Because I hear that applied to everything. And then over the years, you've documented, others have too, but you've brought to the trumpet the ways in which the AfD is far right. They are fed up. People are fed up with what you call the identikit politicians, right? This you just basically have this thing that squeezes out European politicians, and they're all kind of the same.
Yeah, and they're pretty bland and boring. And we have them here in Britain too. You know, Sir Keir Starmer, our prime minister,
Right, and we have
mainstream
them in the
beliefs and
United
tries to be
States,
inoffensive.
this uniparty thing where the first time you heard that, it was probably from one of your conspiracy theory friends or something, you know, uniparty. And now people in the uniparty are recognizing that that there's kind of a uniparty, and you know, certain Republicans will speak out against that to try to appeal to voters. But there's this establishment that just sort of amalgamates different things and allows inexplicably some of the things that you were mentioning in Europe. I mean, just letting people pour over the borders, letting societies that were built over generations, over centuries, especially in Europe, just be destroyed, be torn down, be not just like physically graffitied or whatever, but just the institutions and the beliefs and the heritage that Europe especially has, Europe and Britain, even more, you know, far more so than America. They're letting that go. And some people are saying that, you know, as I wrote about in this issue, we're not going to give that up. We're not going to give that up. And maybe what I've been hearing about everything from the politics of the day, to the AfD, to World War II itself, to Adolf Hitler himself, is wrong. You know, maybe, you know, and so people are looking for solutions. They are rightly identifying that Europe is a mess. You can trace it right back to the politicians who are going out of their way to do things that are self-destructive to national sovereignty, to to citizen safety, the most basic thing, to certainly to their taxpayer, you know, their economy and what they pay their taxes into. And so people are ready to react. I don't know how strong it is, and I don't know how it's going to go, but there's definitely that undercurrent. And like you said, the stats that you put in this Europe, Who Will Drain Europe swamp, were shocking to me. And you mentioned it in meetings and so forth, at, you know, the AfD and these other parties, where they were before to where they are now. It's a different Europe. Like, things are definitely in flux there in a way that I didn't even really understand or anticipate.
And that changing nature of things is important to note, and it is changing quickly. I mean, on that point about how we characterize the AfD, I don't think they were around when I was in college, so it's a little more recent than that. But we did. There is nuance, and we try to be accurate. So when the AfD first came along, they were a party of economists that were upset about bailout procedures, and they were pretty small and pretty niche, and we didn't call them far right. I tried to push this term, to kind of popularize this term, fringe right. It's not really caught on. I'm not influential enough to make that happen, unfortunately. I like it because it's non-judgmental. You're like, far right, you're condemning a party. Fringe right can be objectively true, I think. Like, they are a fringe party. They're a new party. They're not one of these parties that's been around for decades and decades, or that's got this long history of prime ministers or chancellors. And I feel like you can say that, and you can say these are far right, and maybe some of these fringe parties would be far right, maybe some of them would be not. But it's a broad umbrella term that is accurate. I do remember, like, we made a conscious decision to start using the term far right at a specific point in the AfD's development. And I believe it was when Bjorn Höcke, there was a video of him talking about condemning the Holocaust memorial that was bought in Berlin, complaining that Germany's history was made to look shameful, that Germans need to be proud of the achievement. Well, it was Alexander Gauland who, around the same time, he said Germans need to be proud of their achievements, not just throughout history, but specifically of their soldiers in two world wars. And for this Bjorn Höcke speech, it was in, it might have even been Thuringia, the same place that they had the election. It was there, or it was Bavaria. And he's in a pub, and the whole crowd is just shouting, Deutschland, Deutschland, Deutschland. And I watched the video, and if it weren't for kind of camera quality and things like that, you wouldn't know whether that came from the 1930s or whether it was modern. So it is a party that has shifted over time. And this is a trend where I think, as the radical left have shifted to the left, there's a trend for central conservatives to shift to the left as well. But then I think there is also a trend for some to shift further to the right. And we've seen that in Europe. I think we kind of see that even online, where people are kind of like, well, the left are going to call us racist no matter what. Let's just be racist. Like, that's not a majority of those on the right, but there are some that are doing that. And that are just so fed up of kind of the whole diversity, equity, and inclusion agenda or whatever, that they're kind of actually pro-discrimination and like have genuinely crossed the line into real, actual, wrong, evil racism. It's a minority. It's a small minority. But you've seen that happen. And I'm not saying that's the AFD. That's a few people online. But there is that dynamic where as the left embraces this, the right goes in another direction. And you see that in Europe again with, okay, my heritage is being torn down around me. Everything that I love about my nation is being degraded. My cities are full of rubbish. I'm told I can't enjoy my nation's music and culture and art. I certainly can't avoid walking. I can't walk around these ancient European cities. It's no longer beautiful. It's full of graffiti and dirt. And so I want to really embrace and hug much tighter that history. And you know, this is where we're getting out the warning about the radical left, but we also warn about that specifically too. And that Europe returning to its past and embracing its heritage, well, that is a heritage that has a mixture of good and evil. That there are some things that uplift and inspire from that heritage that people are holding on to. But there's this Holy Roman Empire. This is a history that is embedded with violence. That is not, you know, World War II is not this kind of aberration that's carved off and separate. You can go back thousands of years and you look at the Holy Roman Empire of Charlemagne. And that this is something that someone that massacred tens of thousands of people that came along and wiped out, you know, almost genocidal levels of violence so that they could try and convert people to Catholicism. There's a movement to really embrace the Roman Empire. And again, there are things like, there is aqueducts that, I think there's bridges in Spain that cars drive over that were built by the Romans. And I find that absolutely mind-boggling. There are incredible things to admire about that civilization. This is also a civilization that went into Gaul and killed 2 million people. Before the invention of there is horror and destruction on a hard to imagine scale with that empire as well. And so we're also warning about people embracing that too, and saying by embracing that, this is a trend that's going to lead Europe into not just embracing the things that are wholesome, and maybe we will see a revival of some of the art and the culture that is genuinely beautiful, but we're going to see a revival of that kind of killing. We're going to see the revival of, okay, we're in multiculturalism right now. We're going to go to the opposite extreme of absolute religious intolerance and religious persecution. That is coming. And the Bible tells us that that is coming. And so, you know, because of the degradations of the radical left, there are people that are actually embracing right now what we have been warning about for decades. And we've been making it a warning. And they're out there saying, no, this is a great thing that we all need to get behind.
Right. And it's interesting that that has been the warning, because in the United States, in Europe, we've seen it go just from extreme liberalism and extreme hedonism and extreme, you know, sensual gratification, materialism, and then to the point what I call anti-humanism, which also hasn't caught on, but it's just anti-human, some of the actual policies that are being advanced in terms of sexuality, in terms of just basically self-destructive behavior, self-destructive things that are made into law. And it is insane. And the Uniparty or the identikit, you know, EU politicians absorb elements of that, lots of elements of that into this kind of blob of governance that's happening in, on both sides of the Atlantic. And so it's horrible. It's horrible. And the prophecy, the Bible, the trumpet has been saying that Europe's going to be conservative religiously, to put it mildly. And it hasn't done that. It's not because we recognize something and then we said, oh, that we can see where this is going. It hasn't been going in that direction. But what we're trying to cover in this print issue is it looks like we can start to see that reaction. We can start to see that reaction, certainly on kind of like a cultural, a social media type of level. You'll see, you know, somebody who's bold enough to say masculinity is good and femininity is good, and I don't want to like destroy those differences and make everything just kind of this gray blob. I love the old ways and the traditions. You know, men, be men. And it'll have some like bracing quote that is 100% true and much needed. And the bravery it took for that person to say that quote or whatever is commendable. But then that grainy background image that also looks cool happens to be a World War II German soldier, you know, for those who know what the helmet looked like, you know, you just know it's an old fashioned soldier, but it happens to be a World War II soldier specifically. And as you said, we've got AFD politicians and others saying our fathers, our grandfathers, they were, you know, they were school teachers and whatever. And then they went and they fought for the fatherland. And that is true. And some of them fought bravely. That is true. There's good mixed in with the evil. If you want to find good in a World War II German soldier, you will. You can find it. Somehow they're trying to find it in the SS in World War II, which is I don't think there's any good in that entire unit. You covered that in this article. But that's where you start to see this, the danger of the backlash. Like the backlash by virtue of being a backlash against evil is not automatically good. Once you've backlashed against the evil, finally, the rampant radical liberal, social, anti-human, sexually crazy, economically crazy evil that is the establishment at this point. Once you've backlashed against that, you have a world of decisions to make. The job is not done. Once you've backlashed, you've got it's a minefield. Once you turn away from that blob of multiculturalism and modernism and materialism, and you say, I want something real. I want something good. I want something right. I want something elevating. I see those things in the past. Your quest has only just begun at that point.
That point about history, and like we have seen Beware the Backlash, we've seen this before. And I think this is kind of the kind of ironic thing about this subject. So there's a book that I really like. It's called The Europeans by Luigi Barzini. He was an Italian journalist, and each chapter is just these different kind of vinaigrettes or descriptions of different countries around Europe. And I think he has even the Americans, but there's like the Italians, I think there's the British, the French, and he just kind of describes his experience visiting this nation over a period of time and draws out some general, very general comments about what these people are like. And I think his chapter on the Germans is excellent. It's called The Mutable Germans or The Changeable Germans. And he talks about how Germany can change very quickly. And he goes through and talks about visiting Germany at several different points during the 1930s. And at one point he's there and he talked about just how debauched and immoral and licentious Berlin was, and how then it changed very quickly and that the Nazis were a reaction to that. But then what really surprised me is, okay, I've read that book. I saw one of these kind of go back to tradition social media accounts sharing a screenshot of a page from that book saying, see, the Nazis weren't so bad. You know, see, the Nazis were just standing up for tradition and conservatism and traditional European values against the same attack that we see going on today from immorality and transgenderism and all of that that was going on in 1930s Germany. And it was kind of like, wow, I would have never have gotten that from Bardini. I mean, it's more a warning, I think, of, hey, you get the left and, you know, this is where it can come and beware the backlash. And it's a warning about, yeah, just as you said, they're going badly wrong in this direction. There are plenty of other directions that you can choose that are also badly wrong. Just because you're not going that way doesn't mean you're going in the right direction. But their takeaway was, well, the Nazis aren't so bad.
Yeah, you've taken the first step when you do that. And it is good. It's absolutely good to step back from the Weimar debauchery. Like, it was a non-functioning government. People were, still shell-shocked from World War One. They just, like, turned to whatever. They wallowed in the destruction and the shattered bodies that came home from that war. And there was abundant evil to finally react against. But like you just said, there were many options for the German people in their homes and in their morality and in their decision making to turn to when they turned away from that horrible non-functioning government. And if you can believe this, I've seen a documentary on the artistic and architectural and literary positions of National Socialists in the 1930s and maybe probably into the 1920s, if I'm not mistaken. But basically, they said, enough of this. We're going to build a great society. We're going to clean up the conditions of the worker. We're going to, you know, the worker, the socialist. We're also proud of our nation, National Socialist. And we're going to build great things. And the example I always use is Hitler and his architect, Speer, said, not in these words, but they said, we're going to build buildings, parade grounds, arenas, a Capitol building that will look amazing as ruins in 1,000 years, right? So that's pretty awesome, you know, to say, you know, let's build, let's be great, let's build roads that you can drive on in a 1,000 years, and people will say, wow, the people that did this were amazing. Let's do something great. Enough of this wallowing and this hedonism and this just endless sensual gratification that people are pursuing in increasingly horrible ways. That's exactly what the National Socialists were rebelling against, reacting against, backlashing against. And they offered then their solution. And many sophisticated, good German farmers and teachers and mechanics and clerks and accountants signed up for that and said, I want to be a part of that. So that's just one example of how, like you said, history shows that a backlash against a bad thing is only the first step that needs to be taken.
And this fact that really both sides are kind of a mixture of good and evil. I mean, I'm struggling right now to come up with anything good from the radical left. I don't know, maybe standing up for the weak or the underdog, but this kind of almost leads to this cycle where you can criticize somebody for liking the good. Like, I've seen this. You mentioned some of this online appreciation for good architecture and buildings, and they'll kind of criticize the brutalism that does kind of come from the Soviet era and was kind of even designed to crush the human spirit and make the individual feel very insignificant in comparison to the all-powerful mass of the people. But you'll see some of these sites that will praise good architecture. And then in response, people along from the left will come and say, hey, you know who else like good architecture? The Nazis. And they'll share some of the same pictures from Albert Speer and say, well, this looks exactly like what you're promoting. So actually, people that like good architecture are Nazis, which, again, I've said kind of some of those people, a small number, have kind of walked in that direction. But that's just not true, that if you like good architecture or not. So it's this weird, like, yeah, that you can, you take the mixture of good and evil, and well, this evil thing had a mixture, had some of that good that you like mixed in with it. And we can all sling mud at each other as well. But then that dilutes the message we're getting across. Because
right.
People have made this argue. I think it makes it harder to articulate exactly what we're warning about.
Right. And that's what I tried to tackle in my article, is kind of the more cultural, I guess, side of it. And to make this point that it's you can't prepackage it. you can't prepackage. Well, I'm against Democrats here in the United States, so I'm for Republicans. Partially because people often say in this country, America's split 50-50 right down the middle. Well, we've been saying that for about 200 years. And the reason for that is because the two parties move. they move their policies. They move their rhetoric to reflect the people. They're trying to get 50% or more of the people. And so it's the people's decisions at the kitchen table and at the school board or the, you know, the local elections or whatever it is, or in the home, I mean, that then those parties are trying to take advantage of. So that's why it's almost always split, not always, but it's almost always split 50-50, is because they're chasing the beliefs of the people about what is good and evil, and the morality of the people. So we're sitting at home thinking we have no power, especially in the United States. The other countries, Europe less so, and other countries far less so, have agency and power to alter their government. But the government does reflect either what the people have voted for or what the people will allow, the abuses that the people will allow to occur. So in my article, working title, The Old Made New, I really tried to focus in on that culture. And since I manage some of the social media, or one of the social media accounts we use, then I can sometimes see, when I'm checking that account, like what's out there on social media, and the algorithm tailors things to each person. And so my experience, I'm sure, is not the same as everybody, but my experience over the past, let's say, 2 or 3 years compared to my experience over the past 2 or 3 years before that has changed. And what it's changed to be is many accounts like the ones you were just talking about. Look at this architrave of this building. Isn't it neat how they did that? It's actually a marvel of engineering because they had to do this, this, and this, and they didn't have hydraulics and they didn't have pneumatics. And wow, isn't that amazing? Yes, it is. Cool. Show me more. You know, and one account I'm thinking of in particular, and I mentioned it in the article, says exactly what you just said. Here are pictures of cool buildings. Here's how they work. These are facts. And then it asks, why don't we have more of these buildings? We have far more tools. We have far more resources. We have far more money. We also have institutions of freedom that allow for more circulation of materials and knowledge for building things. Why are we building ugly buildings? That has to be a choice. And so they'll make that point. And that is almost as self-evident as the beauty of the Colosseum, you know, or as the beauty of the buildings that they are talking about in the first place. And so the trend that I'm seeing is people who are increasingly willing to say the old was good. Bring back the old. Look to the past for the buildings that they built to see how we should build our buildings today. Let's reject the brutalism. Let's reject the Corbusier, you know, the let's reject this worship of the collective and the and let's get back to the dignified, the beautiful, the ornate, the proportions that exist in nature and those types of things. And there is abundant good to be found in that. In the classical compositions of the past, musical compositions, in the old ways, and in the individuality and independence of raising your own food, let's say homesteading, we call it in the United States, or of any number of things. The one example I mentioned is here in the United States. Some of the retro cars are coming back, like the new Ford Bronco, the new, you know, whatever, looks a lot like the old one. And there's an appeal to that. And there are people saying, well, kind of one of the slogans is, they took this from us. You know, they'll show a picture of one famous picture is Tulsa, a group of teens in Tulsa in the 50s. And they're wearing the 50s clothes and they're happy and they're, the women or the young women are not, you know, are look dignified and feminine and, you know, what we used to think of as normal. And the men look like young men. And then people will just post the picture like that of 50s Americana or the ornate buildings of Europe or whatever it might be. And they'll just post that underneath. They took this from us. We could have done this, they say. And instead we've had this modernism era, and I'm seeing that more and more, and I hopefully can portray it in text and visually in this issue to just make you aware that it's there, and it is absolutely refreshing in a thousand different ways.
One of these days we'll have to get Sam Livingston over from the Trumpet Daily on and. The three of us, we'll just spend an hour talking about architecture. Right. And maybe no one will watch the show. But that's the thing with YouTube is you can always find an audience for whatever niche. And we'll just have a good talk about what architecture says about society. I do think I see some of those accounts on Twitter, and I do think it's really, really interesting. I should also put in that caveat that... You know, you mentioned the working title. We are taking a risk with today's show because the magazine isn't actually finalized. We're having to record this a little bit in advance. I'm traveling next week. We're hoping to bring you our first ever on-location Trumpet World, so you've got that to look forward to. But it means we have a draft. It is entirely possible, perhaps, that parts of this issue that we're talking about don't actually make it into the final product. We do that sometimes. We'll decide, actually, this is a little undercooked. Let's put it back in the oven. Or if Israel and Hezbollah absolutely blows up over the weekend, it's quite possible we'll decide, okay, we need to rush something on that into the print, and some of these will get yanked. So hopefully, I think whatever we're talking about, we'll try and make sure does make it up online in some form before too long, so you can have what we're talking about, and we can probably clarify some of that in the show notes. But your article, The Old Made New, at least with the working title there, what I did really like about that is I did like the positive take that this has, that, you know, this harking back to the past, it is an interesting subject because I don't know of any time period in history that we have abundant written records for where we don't have written records of people saying, oh, things were so much better in the past. Like the Roman Empire has this 600-year period of history that we have written records for, and every time period, prominent writers are talking about how wonderful it used to be. Like there is always a tendency to glance in the rearview mirror. You know, look at all in Britain history, and every single reform and every change to the British Constitution and the British that has ever been made is generally marketed as putting things back to the way it used to be. But I mean, you kind of bring out that there is a that conservatism. The idea fundamentally is you look in the rearview mirror and you throw out what is bad and you keep what is good. And that there is then some truth and virtue to this approach.
Right. And kind of to that last point, conservatism, or looking to the past, or even to some degree nostalgia, but certainly conservatism implies judgment. The way I heard it expressed well was the very oldest human family had a murderer for a firstborn. We don't want to conserve that. So we're not conserving the past because it is past. Well, some people are, you know, some people do fall into that trap. And maybe that's one thing where the progressives or whatever could say, well, you know, the past has always been really bad. Well, it has. So it's judgment. You have to judge the past and you have to judge the present. You're using judgment to know that people with dyed hair and radical ideas who want to take a certain amount of control over your child's mind is evil, right? You're judging the current situation. It's not evil because it's current. It's evil because it's evil. And the same thing is true of the past. You have to walk through this minefield, judging things as evil or good, conserving the good, and rejecting the evil just as powerfully as you reject the current evil. So that requires judgment. Conservatism is judgment. But the question that I try to pose there is, what are you judging by? Because if you judge by your own what feels right, so are the radical progressives that you can clearly see are wrong. They're using their own judgment. The identikit politicians in Brussels who do nothing for the people, they're basically using their own judgment. Everyone's using their own judgment. We've been doing that since the first human family, using our own judgment for what's right and wrong, what's good and evil. And so as we're facing this kind of grand smash of horrible human government, and where even the backlash is going in a horrible direction, in so many cases, you have to say there needs to be, we need something that we can judge the past against, the current against, the future against. We need something that can that we can judge it and to actually judge rightly, to accurately judge good and evil. Because another point that we make in there is that evil is almost always mixed with good, almost always. Like, that's almost never do you have evil coming and saying, you know, come be evil. There's always some reason. There's always some good. There's always some, you know, something or something that sounds good to it. Otherwise, millions of Germans don't follow Adolf Hitler if there's not some good mixed in there, right? Something. And we need the creator to give us the judgment to understand good and evil. Some things we think are good are actually evil. Some things we think are evil are actually good. We need to surrender that ability or surrender that prerogative to the one from whom all the good came from. And it'd take too long to get into it, but you could trace every actual good in architecture, every actual good in automotive design, every actual good in painting and poetry to the creator of good, the creator of human beings. That's why it's actually good, is because he gave that ability, that capacity, and that creative urge that the greats have had. So it's not the greats, it's not the people, it's not the Caesars or the architect or the shipwright who was great, but rather that good that he did, that great that he did, traces back to God. And if it doesn't trace back to God, it's not actually good.
That is the point that I really did appreciate the most from your article, that you see the same with marriage and this, well, let's get back to traditional marriage roles. I mean, yeah, that is absolute good. That gets back to how God created families to be run and marriages to be run. And when people are getting back to that, they're getting back to good. Now, of course, when you look at, say, something like the Tradwife movement, yeah, there's some good and evil mixed in with that. There is kind of some, you know, people have pointed out some of these people are like, it's fake, it's phony, that's not really how they're living their lives. It's all under the glare of camera, and when the cameras are off, it's something different. And yeah, that may well be true. But fundamentally, the good that a lot of this conservatism is getting back to is good that is given to us from God. And I think you just, it was really nice to have something very positive and practical in this issue that was like, yeah, well, there are good things that you can get back to with this history, and you need to be discerning. And I think when you have that perspective and you realize, well, yeah, it gets back to what comes from God, and he guides us in seeing what is good and evil, that does help us pick out what is wholesome and what is great from the past, and allows us to enjoy that, and allows us to reject the evil that comes from it. We can take a quick break now. When we get back, we'll talk about an article I think that is pretty similar to that, on a similar subject of conservatism. We had a plan for this discussion that bears no resemblance to what we have actually talked about, but I've enjoyed the discussion. So I think we'll take a quick break. We'll get back into that, and then we'll kind of come back, I think, to this issue of politics that is downstream from culture, and talk about that. We'll be right back in a minute. Welcome back to Trumpet World. We've been talking with Trumpet Magazine Assistant Managing Editor Philip Nice about our upcoming Trumpet print issue that is all about politics in general, but specifically some of these big trends you're seeing around the world, a shift to the far left and then a shift to the far right. Well, which way do you go? How do you move forwards? Where you see evil on both sides? We've talked about conservatism. We've talked about this trend in Europe to kind of embrace the far right as a reaction to the far left. What you see all around the world, and we have one particular article that focuses on it in America also, is this drift where, yes, there are some that look back to the past, but there are also many that constantly allow their moral values to drift as dictated by whatever the other political party is doing. And Trumpet Managing Editor Joel Hilliker has an article here, Is America Turning Conservative? That talks about the way that the Conservative Party has been radically transformed over the last couple of decades. And really, it's been a drift, I think, that's there pretty much always, but it has been turbocharged recently to the point where you have some pretty immoral people. Was this, am I misremembering it, or was she genuinely a kind of she was a rapper. I think she's almost been into at least softcore pornography. And yeah, and she's pro-abortion and like a pretty left-wing person who was speaking at the Republican National Convention. And this is the first time where the Republican National Convention doesn't oppose homosexual marriage. I mean, really, mankind cannot redefine marriage, whatever the laws say. Two men, it's not a marriage. But the Conservative Party has dropped their opposition to that, or the Republican Party has dropped their opposition to that. It's dropped its support for a federal abortion ban. It's getting in, like, this is a party that has embraced Bruce Jenner, who is now calling himself Caitlyn. Like, there is also a very strong push within the right to try and get that 50% of the vote that you were talking about earlier. And so to do that, it feels like, well, we've got no choice but to compromise with the values of the majority. Otherwise, we're simply going to be out of power and we're not going to be able to do anything.
Right. We're talking about this backlash against the extremes of liberality, if you want to call it that, that's taking place in Europe, that's taking place in the United States and elsewhere. And some people, some politicians are taking advantage of that. But as we talk about in the article draft, we don't know how strong that is, how strong it's going to be. We do have a pretty good idea of where it's headed in Europe, despite the rampant secularism of the past few decades. We're expecting a very strong return to conservatism, quote unquote, there, or conservatism of a certain kind. But that at the same time, this uniparty, this or this Republican Party in the United States, what's supposed to be our conservatives, is doing what people seeking power, whether it's a democracy or not, are always doing, and that's trying to amass enough support from the powerful people, or many, 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 many more of the less powerful people. That's always how someone gets to the top of the government, whether he's a dictator or an emperor or a king or a senator, ancient or modern. And so you have to realize again that the platform, the policies, the things that we're going to be fighting for in the first place are what matter. And if you focus on that, you realize, like my dad told me, John F. Kennedy would be a Republican candidate if he kept the same policies back when he was actually running for president. In the 60s, he was a fairly radical liberal in policy. So if you put on the night vision goggles and you see things differently than they are on the surface, that and you're and you're set to policy, principle, good and evil, or what you think of as good and evil, then you see the Republican Party in the United States badly drifting, and like you said, at this point, not even drifting, but accelerating toward these ideals, these definitions of good, whether it's spending trillions of dollars with no plan, which is a wrong thing. That's just wrong. It's wrong to do that. It's wrong for you to do that to your creditors. It's wrong. But then obviously the moral situation and the education of the young and those types of things, it's shifting badly. So there is a backlash against it. And even the Republican National Convention is kind of supposed to be a backlash against it. And yet, like you said, it had this celebrity with a terrible moral background who even refers to herself as we sometimes, if I remember right. And so you see that infection is the case in the Republican Party. So is America turning conservative? Is such a good question. You talked about how the article that I wrote was more positive. That's thanks to the editor, managing editor, Mr. Hilliker. He's like, you need to make this more, you need to get a little deeper and go to why this is positive, because this is where I wanted to take it, was look out when somebody's backlashing against the evil, which in the United States, MAGA, it stands for an explicit rejection of the present and an appeal to the past. That's an acknowledgement that we're not great. In the past, we were greater than we are now. And so that's a, and there's a lot of good in that movement. There's a lot of courage in that movement for sure. And courage is a virtue. And some have said it's the most important of the virtues. So that movement has spades of virtue in it. It's certainly at the human level. And some of that you can trace back to God, courage, political courage, moral courage, physical courage. But if the reason you're supporting them is because you believe abortion is wrong, or you believe that what certain people shouldn't be promoted and popularized, and our young people shouldn't look to their leaders and see a rapper or whatever it is that she is, or and many other examples. I mean, this is just the example that's in this article. If you believe that, then you kind of don't have a home in either party, and to some degree, with some of these issues of right and wrong, good and evil, you don't have a home in even that popular movement that kind of stands a little bit outside of the Republican Party, the Make America Great Again movement.
And that is an important perspective to have, because you do see headlines saying America is becoming more conservative, America is becoming more right wing. And it, yeah, you can look at it and say, wow, Americans are rejecting basically child abuse of children through the transgender movement. America is overwhelmingly rejecting that. Great, America is becoming conservative. But you take a step back and it's like, no, the fact that we're even, that this is even an argument at all shows how radically to the left that we've shifted. And the fact that that is the point that conservatives are standing up for, they're not standing up for, you know, 20 years ago, it was standing up against divorce, or that maybe you'd have to go back 30 years ago. We're probably at least half a century, if not longer, on from conservatives standing up for traditional roles within families. Like, America taking a stand there is not America being conservative. And the other thing I appreciated from this article is, I think your article brought out one virtue in conservatism, in that you're going back to basically what comes from God in preserving what's good. I mean, this brought up this fact that you look at Malachi 3 and verse 6, for example, where God says, I am the Lord, I change not. I mean, in that sense, you could say God is conservative. I mean, really, we're not necessarily promoting one political philosophy over another. And I think you could pick issues with, say, you know, Burkean conservatism, much as I admire Edmund Burke. You know, we're not holding that up, say, as God's system of politics. But in that sense of having an unchanging moral standard that remains today, yesterday, today, and forever, and that doesn't shift with the times, and it's not an evolving constitution, in that sense, God is a conservative. And that this conserving and refusing to change with what is past fits, is a part of God's nature and characteristic. And so then a big part of God's condemnation against America is that they've shifted away from, okay, there's never been perfection. There hasn't been a time where everything was completely without problems, but they've shifted away from what truth they have and from what good that there was. And I think that's just a great perspective on what is going on within America at the moment, and not just America, around the world as well.
Yeah, what truth they had, right? So that's an explicit acknowledgement that we've been good mixed with evil in this country and every other country since Adam and Eve. like we have, the good has been mixed with the evil. You want to go back and find evil in the American past or anywhere else, you're going to find it. It's squalid. Human history is squalid. And yet, for some reason, certain things have happened where you can't deny that the British Empire lifted more people out of poverty and moral poverty, you know, just ideological poverty, as well as slavery, than anything in human history. That was good. That was a good thing. You know, I'd actually like to come across that more in this, and see, learn more details about that than about Pompey or, you know, Crassus or some of these Roman emperors that have less to teach me than that did. But anyway, what truth they had. There was some truth that filtered through the human morass, not because the British were better. Britain just had better people. They're just better moral people. And not because the Americans were better people. And this is where I think conservatives are weak, is because they don't know how to explain that. They know it was good. They know that many of the things that George Washington did and many of the things that Thomas Jefferson said and many things that John Adams instituted, Madison instituted, are good, but they can't trace it back. They don't know how to trace it back to where it came from. Well, it came from the creator of good, because human beings can't generate good, so it came from the creator of good. And when you're trying to look at it from that perspective, then you realize how much we package certain goods and evils together. And this article just pierces through that and says, if good is good, then it can't change, can it? Because that's the entire reason so many people are upset with progressives and radical liberals, and is because they just changing everything, and what even they said was good a few years ago, now that's racist or whatever, and you've got to be even more extreme. This says the good is good, doesn't change. That's why certain traditions are good. Certain traditions are bad for sure, and that's absolutely the case. So when you're judging the traditions, when you're judging the institutions, when you're judging the past, then you need to be judging it by something. And that's why, like he says, it's not good to move the ancient landmark, because that's again that this metaphor for, like you said, God changes not, and when he gives the good. It's so rare in this society for it to survive, or for you to be able to identify it in human through the human millennia, that you better hold on to it, once you come across it. So I think the way he pierces through this, really through the news of the Republican National Convention and the Republican official platform, really shows you that the grand lesson in the disaster that's happening in this country's politics is not get back to the 1980s or get back to the 1880s or the 1780s. We need to learn a much bigger lesson than that. Definitely need to backlash against the extremism of the left. But if good is good, then there needs to be a backlash against some of the assertions and actions of the conservatives.
I mean, maybe that's the biggest divide in American politics today, or world politics, or the most important, is between the conservatives and the constructivists. Like, this term social constructivism doesn't really get used much outside of academia, but it refers to this worldview that looks back at the past, and conservatism says, looks back at the past and says, well, why were things the way that they are? They were probably our forefathers had good reason to do it that way. And it doesn't necessarily say don't change anything, but it says be careful. They probably had it for a good reason. Okay, maybe we could experiment with doing something a little bit different, but let's go slowly, let's go cautiously, let's go step by step. Edmund Burke, kind of in terms of articulating this philosophy, it grew out of opposition to the French Revolution, which was just burn everything down, get rid of everything that is old, throw it all out, start again. And he was really articulating the value of preserving the ideas, the institutions, the traditions, even the aristocracy of what came before. Social constructivism, kind of in academia, it looks back at what was there before, things like marriage and family and even gender roles, and says, well, why are they there? Conservatism says probably for a good reason. Social constructivism says they're probably there for no good reason. And I think it's built out of the foundation of evolution versus creation. I think there's a quote, I wish I had it to hand, from Mr. Armstrong, where he just talked about how so much of the flaws in modern education go back to evolution. This is a subject for a whole nother show, that particular point, but it's so profound because the constructivist mindset says, well, yeah, maybe marriage and family evolved because that's what was best for cavemen or apes 10,000 years ago or more, when we were hunter-gatherers or whatever. But why would that be any good for modern society? We should experiment with something different. We should experiment with different gender roles, different forms of marriage. Why only have two parents in a marriage? Why not have three or five? Try it out. It probably works better because we're evolving, we're more evolved, and that what we did in the past was just what worked for our monkey brains, and we can do something better now. So that is kind of this fundamental dichotomy that we're seeing that I think is just not articulated enough. There's a lot of fluff and a lot of dressing that's put on that, and we very rarely kind of get a look at the skeletons and the assumptions and the beliefs that underpin it.
Right. And I think the marriage being a good example, because the best, at least in this country, that nationally significant Republicans can do is traditional marriage. And we use that phrase too, so it's not a wrong phrase. But this is kind of where both the far left and both the far right and the middle right and everything else is missing, is it's not good because it's traditional. And we don't need to get back to certain things from the institution in the past and not others. We need to get back to one man and one woman, which is an insane thing to say for a human being to be saying. Yes, for sure. And if you mean traditional marriage means one man and one woman, then yes. But like you just said, that's the best you can do, right? That's the battle we're fighting. That's the battle you're going to win is, you know, yeah, you need to win that battle. But it's not that it's traditional that makes it good. It's the fact that some being that had to be better than human beings, greater than human beings, invented the idea that a woman tells a man, you are worth my entire life. I will be with you to the death. And a man tells a woman, you are worth my entire life, and I will be with you to the death. No human being invented that. No society, no tradition. That didn't come from a tradition. Like, how would that come from, you know, how would that come from Mesopotamia or what? No, it didn't. So in a way, it's not about conservatism. It's kind of a bold, new, different, not new, but a bold, different rejection of a whole lot more than just the radical excesses of today, to get back to something that is dazzling. And then once you do that, for all those churches out there or religions out there who say, yes, one man and one woman, okay, yeah, but we've got a lot more work to do before I devote myself to your movement or your church or your political party to convince me, you know why marriage is good, traditional marriage is good, and that you're the solution to the future, because it's too much of a mess at this point. Too many people are suffering too terribly and too twistedly for us to not learn this lesson, that if we're doing this to marriage at this point, if we're doing this to children at this point, then that's it. No, if you're gonna tell me I've got the solution, you better be able to deliver.
That's a great point. And I think that does start to point us towards the article that we'll conclude with from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry. But I think we'll just zip quickly through a couple of other articles that hit on this theme. I mean, we've talked about some of this theme happening in Europe. We've talked about it in the United States. We also have some articles in here that talk about it in Asia. The biggest of these is Putin, the last defender of family values. We had a whole show on that subject a couple of weeks ago with the authors Mihailo Zekic and Jeremiah Jacques. You can, somewhere on the screen, they'll put a link and you can click and you can read that, or you can watch that. And this really, I think, is about somebody that clothes himself in the appearance of conservatism and the appearance of holding on to what is good, but it is a pretty shallow appearance. And this article goes and looks at the light of reality, and it's like, this guy isn't even holding on to traditional morality, let alone pure biblical morality.
Yeah, I think you summed it up really well. And obviously, certain things are right. One man and one woman in a marriage. Vladimir Putin will tell you there should only be one man and one woman in a marriage. Okay, that should tell you right there that you've got more work to do in judging between what he's doing, saying, what he's allowing in his society, what he's doing to the next door society, to his neighbor,
what he's doing in his own personal neighbor, life.
You know, so yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. I didn't really understand it when they were pitching this idea as an article, or the significance of it, but this really does deliver on that and show us that, you know, even just like at, it's not just America and American politics, it's there's this human thing to it where people in the West need to see through Vladimir Putin's propaganda, you know, but we also need to learn that larger lesson there too, that we are subject to propaganda as well, and that we need to be able to have something stronger than our own brains, our own human judgment, to be able to pierce through not only Putin's propaganda, but the deceit that we all are living in.
And that, I think, is something we'll definitely get back to as we get into that last article. There's one more I just wanted to mention here, and this is one that I wrote coming from Asia about Sri Lanka. This was an afterthought. We'd already kind of got our trumpet laid out when I wrote on this, and then just saw this story, and it was like, oh wow, this is a perfect microcosm of one aspect of what we want to talk about here, where Sri Lanka recently elected a Marxist for their president, which in this day and age, to elect a Marxist, I don't think you have to be a radical anti-communist to see that as being a little bit crazy. What makes it even crazier for Sri Lanka is there were two Marxist rebellions launched by the same party that this guy is from. The first was in 1971. That was kind of a smaller one, but people think several thousand probably died in that war. And then they came back again in, I think it was 1988, 1989. And there was a much bigger, much better organized attempt at a Marxist takeover. And it took about 2 years to suppress. Tens of thousands died. And then they just voted this guy into power. And you're kind of like, what in the world? Why? But then you look into Sri Lankan politics. I've written on this a few times over the years. And the established leaders that they have are so crazy bad that even I'm kind of like, okay, yeah, I kind of get why you voted this guy into, like, their leaders have been horrible. There's this whole Rajapaksa family that has basically dominated Sri Lankan politics with some gaps since pretty much 2005, and they've sold the country out to China. Like, they come from, their hometown is Hambantota, that they have made famous because it's kind of become it both for being a bit of a joke and for selling out to China. So the world's emptiest airport, it's been dubbed, is in Hambantota. They borrow all this money from China so that they can build a big fancy airport in their hometown. There is a cricket stadium in their hometown that has more seats than their town has people. Like, it's so plain that the prime minister just wants a fancy cricket stadium in his hometown, so he borrows all of this money from China. But it also gets very serious because he borrowed all this money from China to build this massive state-of-the-art new port in Hambantota that they can't pay off. And that's when this is the kind of most talked about example of debt trap diplomacy, where China stepped forward and says, well, you can't pay your loan. We'll keep the port. We'll have a 99-year lease on it then. And they're taking over a massive strategic seagate, really, to have a port in Sri Lanka. That's huge. And also all of these big construction projects, it's a big con. Sri Lanka controls, it's a state-owned industry. Most of the big companies are state-owned. So they control the companies. They give these massive deals to Chinese companies, these massive contracts to Chinese companies. These Chinese companies then immediately turn around and basically launder that money back to the Rajapaksas and back to their election campaigns. And they're borrowing massively to do this from the state treasury. Then they start printing money to pay these bills. They have hyperinflation. And a country that as recently as 2015 was talked about being kind of like an up and coming, potentially first world nation. And they're really, really accelerating along with their economy. Everything falls apart. You have people dying in queues to get gasoline, to fuel their cars and to fuel their generators because the country is having roving blackouts. Farming industry collapses as the government kind of embraces crazy theories to try, like they ban the sale of the import of fertilizer to try and deal with the foreign currency. And then the farmers can't grow any food. Even when they can grow food, they can't get it to people because they don't have enough fuel. And then people are starving. And it ends in the Rajapaksas being chased out of office. The prime minister, I think it was Gotabaya Rajapaksa at the time, running off to some other country. But then the old guard politicians invite him back and give him a free house, if not a mansion, just a couple of months later. And everything kind of continues as he... And so you see that level of corruption going on. And someone comes along who's, okay, he's a Marxist, but he has this reputation of squeaky clean, anti-corruption, cares about the poor. And you had people in Sri Lanka that have never had any support for Marxism, that have never lent in that direction, but they're like, I'm just fed up. I'm just fed up of all the corruption. I'm fed up of all the nepotism. At one point, there were 40 Rajapaksas in various different high posts in government. And they're just like, fine, if the only guy that seems to have at least half decent morals is a Marxist, get him in. But so that's what's been going on there. But the reason why we stuck it in there is that is kind of what we're talking about, where we're embracing one regime. And I don't know, like, this Marxist guy, he has said, okay, we embrace the free market. Like, he has moved away from Marxism in recent years. I don't want to be his judge about how sincere it is or not, but you know, China's opened their pocketbook again. They've had long links with this Marxist power. It would not surprise me at all, this Marxist party. It would not surprise me at all if this is going to be yet another disaster. But that's where we go. Like, we go from one evil to another evil. We think these guys are terrible, so we embrace this guy. And maybe it's not corrupt autocratic strongmen or Marxists. Maybe that's not the dilemma for your country. But wherever we are, we're in the same position right now. That's Europe between the Social Democrats and the AfD. Like, we're going from one evil to a different flavor of evil.
That's right. I think we need to understand the logic of if the past few thousand years have been as bad as they've been with human government, then it's only logical to say that there's something wrong with European blob politics and Sri Lankan flavors of Marxism, of reformed Marxism, perhaps, and the Chinese Communist Party and whatever's happening in Brazil, and to say, as you mentioned, Herbert W. Armstrong, as he often kind of emphasized, like, the problem is with the human beings. The problem is with the human judgment. And it's just such a siren song. It's such an enticing thing to say, I know I'm not in power yet, but I can rightly say that he's doing this, and this wrong. You got 4 gallons of gasoline a day, and you might die waiting for it. I will change things. You won't have that problem anymore. And people who are dying, suffering, seeing their families suffer, knowing that human beings are made for something greater than this, reach out, you know, I've mentioned this before in the meetings, but I saw an illustration one time, and it was people pulling down a statue, but you could see underground. It was a cross section. An illustration, but the statue was going down, but it was on a wheel of statues. You know, up comes the next one, right? And so that's not to say that there are certain definite evil things particular to Marxism, particular to democracy, particular to republicanism, there's good and evil in both. Otherwise, people wouldn't vote or revolutionize for those things. So they do exist. But again, unless they trace back to the creator, who has some very clear ideas about government, then they're not good. They're deceptive. They're destructive. And again, the reason evil is so destructive is because it's mixed in. And I think you see that here, where Sri Lanka definitely needs to get rid of what it has. The United States definitely needs to get rid of what it has. The Europe definitely needs to get rid of what it has. But unless and until we make the logical conclusion that government is actually super important, and it affects your life, and it can only be done by something greater than human beings and groups of human beings, then we're gonna have problems. They got rid of the czar in Russia. There were a lot of bad things about the czar in Russia. They replaced it with the Soviet Union ultimately, in Russia and in China, they treated people like insects and killed people like insects because they believe that people are like insects and that the health of the hive is the most important thing. Not even a dystopia. I mean, what a horrific thing came from the right rejection of the excesses and selfishness and corruption of the czars, the Romanovs. You know, like, we need to learn a larger lesson. Sri Lanka needs to learn it. We need to learn it.
And that brings us to what's the first article of the Trumpet print. And I wanted to just kind of save that for last, from the editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry's civilization phrase, heed this lesson. Because, yeah, we kind of have been out there. you know, we're pointing all these fingers, like, you know, there is no hope in the AfD, there's no hope in the CDU, there's no hope in the SDP, there's no hope in the Marxists, there's no hope in the radical left, there's no hope in the Republican Party. You know, we've had a go at them today as well. Well, okay, but what do I do? Where do I go? What is the answer? And that's what this article gets into. I mean, this is really getting into actually the core lesson that this time period, this age of man on earth, is there to teach. That we don't have the answers, and God is allowing us to fail in a great variety of ways, so that it is abundantly clear, with no possible excuse, we have tried literally everything, and we can't do it on its own. That is what we're learning. But then Mr. Flurry starts this article by saying there is real hope in genuine solutions to this world's problems. And if you understand them, today's world events point to that hope in a wonderful way. There are solutions, but if we're looking to it in human politics, we are fundamentally looking for it in the wrong place. And the solution will never be vote for this alternative political party, or stand up and fight on the, get out on the streets and protest for this particular movement.
Overall, we're recycling the ideas of the past that also failed and kind of in many cases led to where we are today. I think the first step is to, it's a good title. The first step is to realize this is a civilizational scale thing that's happening. I think a lot of us are still kind of numb to that, or, you know, like it's modern human civilization that is fraying. It's not just the politics of the day. We're dealing with national hazards, when you hear people say what's the term, existential, that means existing. Like the United States existing is now at stake. Western civilization, and even Russia, like even Eastern civilization, certainly Chinese Communist Party, it is shaking and is an existing in danger of not existing anymore, in danger of collapsing, in danger of just erupting into war. Like this is the scale of the thing we're dealing with. So when you understand that, then there is an equally large lesson to be learned, not just a politics of the day lesson, or we need a whole totally new political party in the United States or in Austria or France or whatever.
Who just had an election last weekend that we haven't talked about because we're recording this in advance and don't know what the result was. But they may well have illustrated part of this point, I guess, where they had a far right party that could well have won.
Or like all the campaign promises, maybe went by the time we play this, they mm-hmm. solved all the problems, and we now live in the utopia that every politician and king has ever promised. Maybe that's what's going to be happening when this is actually played, thanks to that election, right? And elections are some of the best forms of government human beings have ever had. Elections in the West in the modern era, like you couldn't ask for something better in this human mess of human government that we've had for millennia. But yeah, as I thought the title was great, as civilization prays, heed this lesson. And that there at the again, right at the end of that first or second paragraph, you must be careful about where you place your hope, you know, not just reactionary, not just, you know, anything but this or the thing that seems the most opposite of this. But like he says there, I mean, he cites these specific examples and yes, these things should be disrupted. Yes, people should be protesting. Yes, people should stop talking about getting rid of these laws or these school boards or whatever and actually do it. But as Mr. Foley says, only God can save this country, in the case of the United States, and it must be to him that we look and not to any man. And that includes ourselves.
And that is the takeaway from everything that we have been talking about. I mean, this is from towards the end of that article, where he says God is actually sending his message to this world, warning of escalating curses people are bringing on themselves and of the mind-splitting suffering and world war that is about to overtake the nations. He is also sending a message of shining hope, revealing how Jesus Christ himself is going to intervene to solve these problems. We are in the very last days of man's rule on earth. And the scale of the problems that we face, the scale of the evil is testament to this, that we've had 6,000 years and all that we've done is spiraled downhill, and that we haven't even been able to conserve whatever good God has given us. And, he gave us marriage and we had that from the beginning and we haven't even been able to hang on to that. And all of these, many other things. And he writes there, when we look around at the crises facing our world today, we ought to see plainly that these are much bigger than any man can solve. Do not be seduced by human beings promising salvation. They cannot save you or anyone else. And I think, we tend to spiritualize away this term salvation. Like it's some kind of mystical thing that you receive. And okay, well, what is salvation? I think maybe a lot of people would struggle to define that, or maybe say, well, it's a state of grace or something like that. I mean, the salvation of the Bible is real and practical, and it is all about the solutions to our problems. I mean, like when we're talking about bringing salvation to the world, we're also talking about fixing the migrant crisis, fixing the education system, or better put, creating a new education system rather than fixing the systems that we have, building new ones from scratch. But it is the solution to those problems that we're all facing. Like, that is what salvation is about. And it's a practical, on an individual level, it's a practical salvation. It's about a way of life that fixes your problems. It's about being saved, not saved in our sins, but saved from our sins, saved from the things that are bringing curses and disappointments and pain into our lives. And yeah, when you view it in that terms, well, of course, we can't look to men to bring salvation. We can't look to men to fundamentally solve these problems, because these problems of human governments are fundamentally problems that only God can solve. And we are learning that we can't solve them.
That's right. I think that's the, like you said, that's the whole lesson. This is a short from the editor article, and it sums it up so well. And it challenges the reader to not just recognize that egregious child mutilation is bad, for example, go way beyond that battle, yes, it is bad, it is evil, it's unspeakable, really. So you've got a lot of battling to do to until you get to the actual solution. And in a very short article, Mr. Flory points you straight to a very logical solution, if you accept the premise that maybe human beings don't have the capacity to govern ourselves and never have, and kind of stole it in a way, like kind of took it to themselves when they never had it, and will endlessly believe generation after generation that we can figure this out. If you're ready to learn a civilizational scale lesson, this points you in a very strong and clear direction.
So the solution to Germany's problems, to Britain's problems, America's, Sri Lanka's, it's in the Bible. And if you're looking and thinking, well, then how can I use that to fix Germany at the next election, or Austria that's voting this weekend, or America as they come to their elections coming up in November? I mean, the short answer is you can't. You as an individual right now, you are not going to fix Austria or America or wherever it is based on the Bible. But you can fix your life. Or you can get to know God and invite him to rule you and to fix your life. And then through you, he can do his work that is going to fix Britain and Germany and Russia and India and all of this world. And that salvation is coming to the world. And so, okay, when we do get people right in, understandably so, you're saying, well, don't vote you condemn the mainstream parties, you condemn the AFD. What do I do? I love my country. I want to fix my country. I want to solve these problems. What do I do? And the best answer we can give you is dig into your Bible and start fixing the problems in your life and getting to know God's solutions for your life. And he can use individuals and have a work that then goes and preaches and bring and tells the world and ultimately is used as part of a way to bring these solutions to the whole world. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Philip. I really enjoy these discussions. We'll do it again when we get the next Trumpet print out, which will be a little bit longer than the last gap. The Trumpet magazine does come out 10 times a year. We do have a little bit of a break coming out. But if you want to get that magazine, if you want to study what we've talked about in much more depth, we would be so happy to send that to you. If you go to our website, thetrumpet.com, scroll down a bit. Hopefully by the time this goes up, you should be able to click on the cover image that I still don't know what it is. You'll be able to go in there. You can read all the articles online. You can download a PDF copy, but you can also order your own free print copy. We'd be very happy to give you a subscription. You'll get it in the post every month. We don't chase after you for follow-up. We don't chase after you for donations. It's all free. I think the only thing we do is every 6 months or every year or so, we send you a little slip that says, hey, you still interested? Do you still want us to keep sending this to you? Just so we're not wasting your time and ours. But beyond that, there's no obligation. So we'll be very happy to do that. You can get that at thetrumpet.com. You can drop us an email at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. Please do give us a like, a subscribe, all of those things on YouTube or Rumble, wherever you're watching this. Thank you to George Haddad and Isaac Lorenz for their help on today's show. We'll be back on Friday. And until then, keep watching your world.